I first have to explain what QRT maps are. So, and the story begins with a polynomial p of x and y in two variables, which is biquadratic. Which means that if you fix y and then view it as a polynomial in x, then it is of degree 2. And if you fix x and view it as a polynomial of y, it's also of degree 2. So it's also called a bihomogeneous polynomial of bidegree 2,2. And if you have such a biquadratic polynomial, then you have the corresponding curve defined by the equation p equal to 0, and that's called the biquadratic, corresponding biquadratic curve. And this biquadratic curve has the following obvious property, that if you keep y fixed, then you have a horizontal axis at the level y. And because it's a second degree polynomial, this equation as an equation in x has two solutions, meaning that there are two intersection points. And these intersection points are x, y, and another intersection point, x prime, y. And the first map which comes into the story is the map which simply switches those two intersection points. So that's an involution. And this involution I denote by iota sub 1, iota from involution, and it's the 1 for the first coordinate. But since the thing is also of degree 2 when you regard it as a function of y, you also have the vertical axis, and you have the vertical switch. So this is the horizontal switch, this is the vertical switch, iota 2. And you get a new point, x prime, y prime. And the composition of these two switches, first iota 1 and then iota 2, that's the QRT map of this biquadratic curve. Of the curve p equal to 0. And it is a map which maps the curve into itself, onto itself. Yeah? It's clearly invertible because both of these involutions are invertible. Now, before I go on, I would like to emphasize that I want to work over the complex numbers, because complex polynomials over the complex numbers have always zeros. And I want to work projectively, because then points at infinity will be included. So that makes that all the curves which appear are compact, complex curves. I will comment on that a little bit later. Biquadratic just means in the it's let me write down a formula so that you understand better what as a function of x. Let's write it in the usual ABC notation. AX squared plus BX plus C. But the A, B, and C also depend on Y. And because it's also a second degree polynomial when you fix X, each of the A, B, and C is a second degree polynomial in Y. And so you get three coefficients, but each of these three coefficients have three coefficients as a polynomial in Y, and so you get a 3 by 3 matrix of coefficients. So a biquadratic polynomial has 9 coefficients. Now, the horizontal switch, you recall the ABC formula for the zeros of the polynomial. I'm looking at the zeros of the polynomial. The horizontal switch, which switches the two zeros of the of this quadratic polynomial, is simply the mapping x goes to minus x minus b over a. And this formula, by the way, shows that the horizontal switch is a rational map. And in the same way, the vertical switch is a rational map, and therefore the QRT map on the curve p equal to 0 is also a rational map. So working projectively now means that you use homogeneous coordinates. So instead of x, I work with two coordinates, x 0 and x 1, and you can think of x as being the quotients of the two. Let me make this clear, that the projective line, the complex projective line, is by definition the space of all one-dimensional linear subspaces of C2. So now this is in C2, and the same way y is replaced by y0 and y1, and I now have a polynomial on C2 cross C2. But the degree two thing now means the following, that if I keep y fixed, then as a polynomial of these two variables, it is a homogeneous polynomial, homogeneous of degree two. And similarly, if I keep x fixed, it's homogeneous as a polynomial of y. And this homogeneity makes that if you look at the equation this equal to zero, and you multiply this vector here with a constant, then you again get a zero. So this whole one-dimensional subspace generated by this point is a zero. And you replace simply the point by this one-dimensional linear subspace, meaning that you get a point in the complex projective line, P1. So this biquadratic curve becomes a curve in P1 cross P1, because the same argument is used for the y. So this is a curve in this compact two-dimensional surface, because complex projective line is compact. So this polynomial, if I then will be something like the following. Homogeneous of degree 2 in x0, x1 means that you'll only take monomials of this form. And homogeneous of degree 2 in y means that you only take monomials of that type. And then you get the matrix of coefficients, aij, and here I and j run from 0, 1, 2. And that's the formula for this biquadratic polynomial. So this is actually the kind of thing which is put into all the computations. Because the point x corresponds to the coordinate x in this affine coordinate in this picture here, this is affine coordinate x and y, the x is the ratio between x0 and x1, you get that x0 equal to 0 corresponds to the point at infinity, whereas x1 equal to 0 and x0 non-zero corresponds to the origin. Yeah? So that's about projective coordinates, homogeneous projective coordinates. Okay. So now the next step is that the QRT map is actually not a map from the curve to itself, but it is a map from the whole plane to itself. So it's a rational transformation of the plane. And in order to get it in the plane, I give myself, instead of only one biquadratic polynomial, I get give myself a whole one parameter family of biquadratic curves, which fill up the plane. So, more precisely, I assume that I have a two-dimensional linear vector space, two-dimensional vector space, of biquadratic polynomials. Let me call this two-dimensional vector space A, a collection of matrices Aij, if you like. Over C. I said I want to work over C. But at some point, I also will go down and assume that the coefficients are all real, and then you can look at the real curves, and you get a number of specific things which you can study for the real curves. And I certainly am interested also in the real picture. But it turns out that the theory is the most complete and uniform in if you work over the complex numbers and projectively. Then it is all very complete and uniform. And then when you want to classify the real aspects, it turns out that you get a much longer list of possibilities. Real and algebraic geometry is much more complicated than complex algebraic geometry, despite the name. I give myself this two-dimensional vector space of biquadratic polynomials, but you can just take two linearly independent biquadratic polynomials, P0 and P1, and just look at the linear combination of these two. This is more down to earth. And then I look at this zero set. So the previous P now depends on Z0 and Z1, two complex numbers. But in a linear fashion, this dependence on the Z's. And that has the effect that if you multiply up both Z's with the same constant, then this zero set remains the same. And that means that this family of curves does not depend on two variables, but actually only on one variable sitting in a complex projective line again. So you get a complex projective line of biquadratic curves. And this kind of situation is called a pencil of curves. I'm throwing a lot of jargon from algebraic geometry at you. If you are an algebraic geometer, then you will know all this. If you are not an algebraic geometer, then you are maybe very impressed about my knowledge about algebraic geometry, which I learned in the past 2 years, actually, doing this QRT stuff. So if you have such a pencil, there's a very peculiar phenomenon going on there, which is the following. This is a two-dimensional vector space, and put better, this depends in a linear fashion on Z0 and Z1. Now fix a point x, y in P1 cross P1. Fix that point. And now look at the set of these Z's such that Z0, P0 plus Z1, P1 is equal to 0. This, because of the linear dependence, is a linear subspace of C2. And now there are two cases. This linear subspace, since it's only one equation, one scalar equation, this linear subspace is either one-dimensional or two-dimensional, the set of all these Z's. So let's first look at the case that it is two-dimensional. That means that this linear subspace contains two, at least two linearly independent Z's, Z0, Z1's. That means, but that's equivalent because this equation determines one of these curves in the family. That means that at least two distinct biquadratic curves of the pencil pass through the point xy. But this is obviously then equivalent, if this dimension is 2, it's the whole space of all z0, z1s. And that means that this is equivalent to all biquadratic curves pass through the point xy. This is the first case. The second case is that if the dimension of this space, this is dimension is equal to 2, this is dimension equal to 1, and these are the only two cases, that this space is dimension 1. But that means exactly one curve passing through the point xy. So there is exactly one z0, z1. This is the notation for the linear subspace spanned by that vector, such that xy on the biquadratic curve with the parameter z0, z1. And that means that, another information, you can count the number of points where this happens. Points where this happens are called base points. Then the point x, y is called the base point. And you can do some algebraic geometric counting, and the count is that there are 8 base points counted with multiplicity, counted in the correct way, in the algebraic geometric way. So there are precisely 8 base points. In particular, there are only finitely many one of those. And if you are not in a base point, so in the complement of those 8 base points, you have through each point exactly one of the family. And that means that this complement is nicely fibered by this tensile of biquadratic curves. So now comes the definition of the QRT map on the plane. You take a point which is not a base point, take the biquadratic curve which goes through it, and take on that biquadratic curve this QRT map, which was this composition of horizontal and vertical switch. And that's the whole definition of the QRT map. And this, because the formulas are rational, this defines a so-called birational transformation of P1 cross P1 to itself. But you have to watch out. Such birational transformations are not true maps, because in the base points they are not defined, for the simple reason that if you are in a base point, you don't know which curve to choose, and you have to know the curve in order to know how the map goes. So now, first picture here. This is a picture of a very, very special example of a pencil of biquadratic curve. Yeah, all of them out. Yeah, the right ones. Thank you very much. This is called the Linnaeus pencil of biquadratic curves, and Richard Cushman knows this very well. Has also been studied by Zeeman, and Zeeman had a beautiful conjecture about it, and Burkers and Cushman proved the conjecture with highly non-trivial means. I hope that I can return to that. But this is the Linnaeus pencil, and here you see 4 base points. And you see very clearly that through each of those base points, all the curves are passing through them. And you also see the projective line coming back, because the tangent lines to these curves passing through that point, these tangent lines are simply all one-dimensional linear subspaces of the tangent space of the plane here at that point. So you see this whole P1 by looking at the tangents at those base points. So here you see clearly that this family is parametrized by a projective line, not by but this is a real picture. So here the coefficients are all real, and this is a picture of the real curves. And so here these curves are projected by the real projective line. And you have to imagine for yourself how the complex picture would look like. Then is it then it is a complex two-dimensional plane, and all these curves then are complex curves. Yeah, that's but that means that all the real dimensions get doubled. Okay, don't mind about about that. What you see also here is in black is that there are some of the curves are singular. Yeah, this curve here has a double point. Or here you see that the real part of the curve has degenerated to a point, and here again. So there are some singular points, singular curves, and that's also a generality. Each such pencil of microquadratic curve, always 12 of them, when counted with multiplicities, you always have to add that to the sentence, always 12 of them are singular. So there are always singular curves when you work over the complex numbers and when you work projectively. In the real picture, it can happen that the base points are not real, and it can also happen that the singular points are not real, and then you don't see any singularities, although they are definitely there, but they are then in the complex domain. Okay, can I have the light back? So this is the QRT map, and the letters QRT, they stand for Crystal Roberts and Thompson. He is originally Dutch, actually from Utrecht. Yeah. Right, I come to that. Very important. Next theorem. You are running just 2 minutes ahead of me. But I wanted to tell where this comes from, this the name QRT. These three persons, he comes from Utrecht originally, but he emigrated to Australia because he couldn't get a permanent job in Holland. And the other two are native Australians. And these people are from mathematical physics. And what they did in 1988 is, by very clever computations actually, they showed that a whole row of difference equations which appear in integrable discrete systems in mathematical physics, that a whole row of them can be put into this framework. And so their contribution is A, to recognize a number of these difference equations as fitting in this framework, and B, setting up this general framework where you give yourself two 3x3 matrices, meaning that you have 18 free parameters to play with in giving such a pencil. So they had this whole row of examples, and they put this row of examples into this general framework of pencils of biquadratic curves. So my entrance to this was relatively easy because I started reading their article, and then I could use this as my definition, and this is a very simple definition, and then I could recognize that this is actually a very fundamental thing about biquadratic polynomials. Biquadratic polynomials, they come automatically with such a map. This is quite seldom, that you start out with give yourself a polynomial, that you then automatically get a map. This one is canonically defined. You need only the polynomial for it, only the matrix of coefficients, to get it. And you get this map. So now, about what... let me also give another picture where the base points are not real. This other picture is about the oldest QRT map, which I know, the oldest as far as I know, which is the elliptic billiard. And that goes as follows. You start with an ellipse, and an ellipse has two focal points, F1 and F2, and the definition of focal points is that if you take a point on the ellipse and you draw the lines to the focal points, then these angles are the same. So put in another way, if you would play billiards with angle of incidence is angle of reflection, then starting with your billiard ball in through one focal point, you go through the other focal point. But of course, you may recognize this as a matter of that the elliptic mirror has these focal points as perfect focal points. Starting with the ray here, you go through the other focal point, and then the reflected ray here will go back through this focal point, and so on. So we'll continue through the focal points all the time. So this is now the point is that here you have only very special rays, namely those going to the focal points through the focal points. But what you can do is take the same focal points and take another ellipse which has the same focal points. So this is a so-called confocal ellipse. And now take two tangent lines tangent to this confocal ellipse, and then the theorem is again that these angles are the same. And this has a very peculiar effect, namely that if you now continue reflecting, the reflected rays are all the time tangent to one and the same confocal ellipse. Allowing this is in Apollonius, and this is in Apollonius when one of these rays is vertical. No, Apollonius did not have this in generality, only when one of the rays is vertical. And then later people found that it is perfectly general, that this restriction of Apollonius was not necessary. But in any case, you not only have confocal ellipses, but you also have confocal hyperbole. This is an example of a confocal hyperbola, and the hyperbola goes continuous like that. And then you take again something which is tangent to this one, it's that one, and then tangent to that one again, and then again these two angles are the same. If you collect now all these three cases, then you get all the rays. So the map here is the following. You have a point X on the boundary and a line through the point X on the boundary, and then it hits the ellipse in another point, in exactly one other point, X prime, and then you use this law of reflection to get the new line. And here you see that the map X go to X prime is an involution, and the map L go to L prime is another involution, and you see that this map is again a composition of two involutions. So you can guess that maybe this can be put in some algebraic fashion into the framework of biquadratic polynomials, and the answer is yes. And so in this way, I don't write down the formulas because they are a little bit complicated. In this way, the elliptic billiard also is an example of the QRT map. And if you then look at the corresponding biquadratic curves, then the picture looks like follows. Oh, I'm sorry. First, there comes another picture of this Lines family, which is the same family, but now looked at in affine coordinates at infinity. This here is the point at infinity. And the horizontal axis is the axis where y, the second coordinate, is infinite. And this axis is where x is infinite. So these two axes are also lying at infinity. And here you see two more base points appearing. They are real, but at infinity. And then here you see still another base point, which is going through the point infinity, in infinity, comma infinity. And this base point is funny, because here, all the curves which pass through it, they all have the same tangent line. And they have a tangency with each other of order 2. And for that reason, this is a base point of order 2. And if you now count the number of base points, we have 4 in the finite domain, plus these 3, but one of them is double, and so you see 8. So the Lenesse case is a case where all the 8 base points happen to be real. And half of them are finite, and the other half are infinite, are at the lines at infinity. Okay? Next picture is the picture of the biquadratic curves for the billiard map. And here you see no base points at all, but there are 8 base points, only they are not real. Furthermore, you see here an elliptic island and there an elliptic island, and these gray lines are the lines at infinity. It happens here that in this algebraic representation of the biquadratic curves, these 2 points lie at infinity. And here you see this picture illustrates very well why I insist on adding the points at infinity. Because otherwise, you would not recognize these curves as being closed curves. These curves, they intersect the line at infinity, so in any finite affine picture, they would be unbounded. And they would not be, not only that these curves are compact, but the real part of these curves, this is the real locus of the curves, actually very small little oval around this point. So they are actually very small. And you would never recognize that if you would not have coordinates around points at infinity. So this is the... Yeah, please, just like that. So this is about the elliptic billiard. Another. This is probably the oldest example. It goes back to Apollodorus. Yeah? Older than that, I think you cannot get with the subject. Okay, now comes the first... theorem about the subject. Already mentioned in the audience. When smooth, that means that the derivative of P is non-zero on all the points of the zero set of P. When smooth, the biquadratic curve, each biquadratic curve, is an elliptic curve. I will explain what this is in a minute and why it is an elliptic curve. And the QRT map on it is a translation. And I also will explain in what sense it is a translation. So that's the theorem. So now let me explain why this is true and what it means, because that's also very crucial for understanding what is going on. And in some sense, this solves the problem of what QRT maps are doing, but only in some sense, because once you arrive at this conclusion, then you want to know more, and I will tell you what you want to know more after that. But first, what an elliptic curve is. For me, the definition of an elliptic curve is curve is elliptic. For me, it means that there exists a holomorphic one form, or better, a 1-0 form, to be very precise, holomorphic 1-0 form, lambda, on the curve. On C without zeros. So no zeros, no poles on the curve. Equivalent to this is there exists a holomorphic tangent vector field V on C without zeros. Because you simply take the vector field such that if you pair it with the one form, you get identically one. And because this one has no zeros, that one has no poles. And because this one has no poles, that one has no zeros. So that's the dual to that you have this vector field. This has an enormously strong consequence, because what you can do is curve, by definition, is a compact, connected, complex one-dimensional analytic, complex analytic manifold. Complex one-dimensional, that's why it's called curve. Real two-dimensional. So that's why it's called Riemann surface for analysts. So having such a vector field, you can look at its flow. And because everything is holomorphic, you can look at its flow with complex time. And because the vector field is non-zero, the flow is locally transitive, but because the curve is connected, it's globally transitive. And so what you get is an action of the additive group of the complex numbers, acts transitively on the curve. And you have a period lattice, those times for which you get back to the original starting point. And so P is period lattice. And if you choose yourself any starting point that whatsoever on the curve, then you get that the whole curve is isomorphic to this complex plane modulo this lattice, this additive group modulo. That's the group which was mentioned in the audience. So the curve gets a sort of group structure after the choice of an initial point. Then you have to then you can identify it with this additive group. But the curve was compact, and that means that the lattice must be two-dimensional over R. So you have this. So you have a basic period, P1, and another basic period, P2, but they must be linearly independent over C. And you can always arrange that this one is that this is an positively oriented basis. And then the whole lattice consists of all integral linear combinations of these two. That's the whole lattice of all periods. Lattice is generated by two basic periods. And so the C mod P, here I have drawn a fundamental domain for it, is, from the real point of view, a real two-dimensional torus. And so all these curves, all these elliptic curves, they are all real two-dimensional tori. So where does the holomorphic one-form come from for a biquadratic curve? Now that goes as follows. Always what I'm talking about now is very well known in algebraic geometry. I'm saying nothing new. I was not familiar with all that, so I suppose that not all of you will be familiar with that. But there are some points to it which I would like to emphasize, and that's why I repeat also the construction. So you start with your biquadratic polynomial P. Now you do the following observation. You have this four form, this volume form, in C2 cross C2. And if you take away the origin, then going through lines, through points, you get a projection pi to P1 cross P1. This is complex four-dimensional, this is complex two-dimensional. And we have this projection, which is by replacing x0, x1 by the one-dimensional vector space spanned by it, and the same way y0, y1 by the one-dimensional vector space spanned by it, and that defines this projection. Yeah? So we have this diagram. Now we have this four form, let's call it omega, but this cannot be related to what is below, because it's homogeneous of degree 2, 2. It's homogeneous in of degree 2 in x0, x1, and it is homogeneous of degree 2 in y0, y1. Therefore, you never can push it down. For that, you need homogeneity of degree 0, 0, by homogeneous of degree 0, 0. But you can simply arrange to get it that way by dividing by p, because this one was bihomogeneous of degree 2, 2, and that one too. And if you take the quotient, it's bihomogeneous of degree by degree 0, 0. So this one can be pushed down. But you cannot push it down because this is a four form and the base manifold is of dimension 2. So you better change this into a two form. And what you to say it more precisely, out of this I want to make a basic two form. So the way to do that is that you take the inner product with the radial vector field, which goes radially in the x coordinates. That's x0 ddx0 plus x1 ddx1. This is homogeneous of degree 0, so the homogeneity degree is not changed. You see an x0 in the numerator and an x0 in the denominator. And you also take the inner product with this Euler vector field in the y coordinate. So you apply these, so you take these inner products with that. And then taking inner product lowers the degree by 1. And so you do that 2 times, 2 inner products with Euler vector fields, you get a 2 form. And this 2 form is automatically basic. And that means that this 2 form is equal to the pullback of a unique 2 form on P1 cross P1. To be more precise, a 2,0 form, an area form. But in the complex sense. So now we have a two form, but this two form, because of the p in the denominator, it has no zeros, this thing has no zeros, but it has pole along the curve p equal to 0. That is no zeros and pole along p equal to 0. In this kind of situation we have seen yesterday in Gualtieri's lecture, having symplectic structures which blew up along a curve. And that's precisely what happens here. And so now, what we now do is simply, you take, for the one form lambda, by definition, you take the residue at p equal to 0 of this theta. And because you take the residue at p equal to 0, you get a one form only on p equal to 0. Taking this residue is something like dividing the thing by dp, but I'm not... So this is the most canonical way of introducing this one form. It has no zeros, it's holomorphic if and only if dp is non-zero at every point of the curve. So if and only if the curve is smooth. And so you get this first statement. Each of these biquadratic curves is an elliptic curve. But this construction does a little bit more. It gives you the one form explicitly in terms of the polynomial p. Not up to a scalar or something like that, not modulo anything, but gives it by a procedure, by an algebraic procedure. And then you also have the corresponding vector field, the dual vector field. So v, comma lambda equal to 1. And you also have that vector field, and you have this identification of the curve with C modulo period letters. Complex numbers modulo period letters. So that is how you define that. And now, why is tau a translation? If you just go through the definition, you find that the vector field V is actually equal to, in affine coordinates xy, coordinates which I started out with my first picture, in affine coordinates, V is equal to the Hamiltonian vector field defined by the function P. And but only looked at this Hamiltonian vector field on the level curve t equal to 0. This last one is very important because otherwise the statement would be false. But on the curve t equal to 0, this corresponding canonical vector field is equal to the Hamiltonian vector field. Now, you can get rid of all this sophisticated rubbish talk about these pullbacks and that I don't know what, by just in a fine coordinate, define your vector field as being the Hamiltonian vector field, and then check that if you take a fine coordinate at infinity, that the same vector field turns out to be regular and without zeros also at infinity. And that's the more elementary way of proving that theorem. Now this local formula for the vector field, they tell you that if you apply the horizontal switch to the vector field, then it goes to its opposite. So the horizontal switch is an inversion in the time parameter of the flow of induces an inversion in the time parameter of the flow. And this vertical switch has the same property. And that means that the combination of the two leaves the vector field invariant. And therefore, it can only be a translation in the time parameter of this flow of this vector field. So you parametrize the curve by flowing out with the solution curves of the vector field. You use the time as your coordinate. But that time is, of course, only determined modulo periods. And that's this identification with complex plane modulo period letters. Yeah? Now, the whole story would be sort of finished with this theorem. But now, of course, you ask yourself, how does the period lattice depend on the curve on which you are? And how does the translation on that curve depend on the parameter z, which tells you on which curve you are? So you get everything depending on this parameter z, which tells you on which curve you are. And for instance, one thing which is very important and a sort of organizing center for the whole subject is that we always have these singular curves in the family, 12 of them. And at these singular curves, you can expect that everything will become singular. Now, that actually turns out to be true. More strongly, if you have a singular curve, then in the neighborhood of that, we work over the complex numbers. So the z value is an isolated value of z. And in the complex plane, you can walk around that. And when you walk around that, then this period lattice, where is my picture of the period lattice? Somewhere here. This period lattice moves when the parameter z moves. And when you come back, turns out that you get a self-map of the period lattice to itself, given by an element of SL2z, 2 by 2 matrices with integral coefficients. And this is a very big group still. And this self-map of the period lattice, that's called the monodromy, when you go around a singular curve. And the strong statement is that every singular curve has around it, around every singular curve, the monodromy is non-trivial, and even stronger, from the conjugacy class of the monodromy matrix, you can recover the type of the singularity, how the singular curve looks like. Kodaira has classified all singularities which can appear in a vibration of a surface by means of elliptic curves. That's the elliptic curves in the title of the talk, by the way, the elliptic surface. An elliptic surface, by definition, is a complex two-dimensional complex analytic manifold, which is fibered by elliptic curves. But the word fibered is here a bit misleading, because you are used to vibrations to be locally trivial. But in the complex analytic category, these vibrations are not locally trivial, because these C mod P's, these C mod period letters, as complex curves, complex analytic curves, they are isomorphic to each other if and only if the period lattice of one curve is equal to the period lattice of the other curve up to multiplication by a non-zero scalar. And that means that you can that there's one parameter telling you which curves are isomorphic or not. And this parameter is called the modulus of the curve, and the function which assigns to z the modulus of the corresponding curve determined by the value z is called the modulus function. It's actually a rational function, and this rational function usually is not constant. And that means that nearby elliptic curves are not isomorphic to each other. As real smooth curves, they are isomorphic. They are just two real two-dimensional torus. But as complex curves, they are not isomorphic. So the word vibration should be between parameters. Also, the vibration has singularities, has singular curves. And Kodaira has classified what kind of singular curves you can get. It's a rather short list, surprisingly short list, because his definition is very general. You would expect very complicated singularities to be possible, but this turns out to be reasonably simple. And he has made a list of them. And what I'm saying is that, for instance, the monodromy tells you which singularity in Kodaira's list you have. So you have seen some of the singular curves there. One of the singular curves, for instance, was the union of three lines. Another singular curve was the union of two projective lines, and so on. That kind of things can happen. Yeah. What should I tell next? Oh, yeah. The picture of... Let me take the first picture. Where is it? Which one? Don't put out the light. Just leave it like that. You have seen this before. But this is not a surface fibered by curves. So in order to get a true surface which is truly fibered by curves, what you do is you blow up the base points. And blowing up means nothing else as you replace this base point by the projective line, namely the projective line of all one-dimensional linear subspaces of this tangent plane here, that projective line. And by doing that, you separate these curves. All these curves go through this point, but they are characterized by which tangent they have. And if you tear those tangent lines apart, then you have obtained a true vibration. Now, the statement is that there is a surface hanging over this one, which is projected down to that, a smooth two-dimensional, complex two-dimensional surface hanging over that, such that the pre-image of any point is just a point upstairs. So the projection from this surface hanging over this one, the projection away from these blow-up points is an isomorphism. But it collapses a whole projective line to the point. And this construction is called blowing up. And the point is that there is a blowing up which is smooth two-dimensional surface. And it is unique up to isomorphism. So then you blow up the base points. If you have base points of higher multiplicity, you have to blow up more times. So you have always, for pencils of biquadratic curves, you always have to blow up 8 times. After blowing up 8 times, you get a smooth, compact, connected, complex analytic surface, which now is nicely fibered by these curves. And since on this surface, at every point now, there's exactly one curve going through it, the QRT map is well-defined at all points of that surface. And so on the blow-up surface, the QRT map is an honest map. It's a real complex analytic diffeomorphism, a true complex analytic diffeomorphism of this surface to itself. And on each fiber, it acts as a translation, at least if the fiber is smooth, because then it is an elliptic curve, and then you can talk about translations. So So to repeat, elliptic surface by definition is a surface which is fibered by curves, and the generic one being elliptic curve. That's the definition of elliptic surface. Blowing up these points, these base points, you get an elliptic surface, but it is provided in the QRT situation, it is provided with an automorphism of that surface which on the elliptic fibers acts as translations. This group of automorphisms of the elliptic surface which on the elliptic fibers act as translations, I'm sorry for this long sentence, this group is called the Mordell-Weil group of the elliptic surface. So you have the elliptic surface, and you have the Mordell-Weil group. And in the Mordell-Weil group, you have this QRT map tau as an element of that. Turns out that the QRT maps for the elliptic surfaces which come from biquadratic families, that the QRT maps are very fundamental, actually. They are fundamental in the following sense, that the whole Mordell-Weil group is generated by QRT maps. I cannot explain, because it takes too long, how that goes, but the QRT map is really contains in some sense all the information about these elliptic surfaces. But I want to mention another property, and that's a property which is related to the question whether, oh, see, if you have a transformation, then the natural thing is to start to iterate it, to make a dynamical system out of it. So you iterate the transformation, and then if you have the kth power, you can look at fixed points of that. Now, the kth power is again in the same group, so on each elliptic fiber it acts as a translation. Now, a translation has a very peculiar property, namely that if one point of that curve is fixed under the translation, then every point of the curve is fixed under the translation. Translations have that property. And that means that if you have one periodic point of period k, k periodic points, they appear as whole fibers, as whole curves from the family. If one point is k-periodic, then immediately all the points on that curve have the same period for the map, are periodic for the k-periodic for the same map. So, interesting question is, where are the periodic curves, k-periodic curves, for the Billiot map? That would mean, when do you get a closed k-gom by doing this? That's evidently an interesting geometric question. Now, the point is that using the algebraic geometry, which is known about these about these elliptic surfaces and about their Mordell-Weil group, you can determine the following. You can get as a consequence the following theorem: if no curve, biquadratic curve in the pencil, contains a horizontal or a vertical axis, and for most pencils this is the case, that if such a situation happens, then the total number of k-periodic fibers, I cannot talk about the number of k-periodic points, because they appear in as curves. But you can talk about the number of k-periodic curves. This number is equal to k squared minus 1. Nice, simple formula. If this condition is not satisfied, then the theory also gives an explicit formula, but it's only a little bit more complicated. But what still happens all the time is that the number of k-periodic fibers is of order k squared. Now, you can also, order k squared as k goes to infinity. Now this order k squared as k goes to infinity you can also determine in an analytic fashion, but I have no time anymore to really describe you the theorems, and instead I will close the whole talk with a picture. And this is a picture about which I'm quite proud, actually. Can you put out the light, please? This is the complex Z-plane, and this is for the billiard map. And this horizontal interval is in the Z-plane is the real axis, but only an interval on it. And it's those values of the parameter for which the corresponding real curve is not empty. One of the things with real curves is that they can happen to be empty. So you get only over this interval, you get the real curves. And so this interval corresponds to the real elliptic billiard, where the rest of the complex plane refers to the complexified elliptic billiard. And then what is marked here is those values of Z for which the billiard map is periodic of period equal to, let me see what the period is, equal to 60. So I've just collected all values of Z for which the billiard map is periodic of period 60 and marked those points in the complex plane. And you have to believe me now, what I'm saying is that these points, they arrange themselves in a certain, how should I describe that, a curvilinear lattice. And the lattice points are at a distance from each other of order 1 over k. And since we are in a real in a plane, real two-dimensional, this is order 1 over k, you get k squared points in each region. Order k squared points. Order, asymptotic order as k goes to infinity. So this kind of asymptotics can be done quite straightforwardly, actually. But what you also see in this picture is that, oh, the picture is left and right, it should be that way. Doesn't matter very much. But it's, of course, symmetric with respect to complex conjugation, because everything is defined over the reals. Oh, it's very asymmetric in that direction. So what you see here is three points in the Z-planes over which there is a singular fiber. And this point here, now let me start with that point here. That corresponds when the confocal ellipse is equal to the outer ellipse. And in the limit, when it is very close to it, it corresponds to rays which almost glide along the outer ellipse. So this corresponds to gliding rays. This here corresponds to the situation that the confocal quadric has degenerated into the double horizontal line, and the rays go through the two focal points. And that's what this corresponds to. And this singular point, which doesn't look very singular in this picture, but it truly is a singular point, that corresponds to when the confocal quadric is the degeneration of these hyperbola when they become two vertical lines, a double vertical line. Yeah. And then the ray just bumps up and down vertically in the middle. And that's what happens around here. So right. So these are really the natural singular situations. What you see here is that the density of these k-periodic fibers becomes very high there. And the density also becomes quite high there, but not so high as here. Here the density is so big that I would need to have very thin points to show them, but then you wouldn't be able to see them. And actually, these arrange themselves in small circles, and the small circles, you can count the number of dots on each circle, and when you go inward to the smaller circle, you get at every step you get two less dots on it. And then you can count how many circles are inside, because it stops at 2 points and then 0 points, so then there is no points anymore. That's where it stops. So you can count how many there are, and you see that inside this one there must be still quite a number of them, number of these circles. Moreover, the smallest circle, asymptotically as a function of k, has a radius of order e to the power minus constant times k. So it's exponentially small. So the singular behavior here is weird. But to my personal opinion, the singular behavior here is even weirder. Because here the density of points looks like zero. Nevertheless, this is also a singular point. And I consider this more weird, actually, than what happens there. Moreover, from these asymptotic lattices, this is a sort of asymptotic lattice, the whole elliptic surfaces can be reconstructed back up to isomorphism. And the reason is that at every point here, you have two of these sort of local bases of two lattice vectors. Yeah? And viewed of them as two complex numbers, the ratio of them really determines the modulus of the curve. So the isomorphism class of the curve sitting over a point here is determined by the quotient of these two base vectors. When you walk around here, then such a local period lattice, such a local asymptotic k-periodic lattice, I don't know how to call that, when you walk around that, then it turns out that you find back also the monodromy from this discrete picture. Even around this point, where you have to go quite far out with your things and walk around with them, still the monodromy around this point is also visible. And it is a theorem of Kodaira which says that if the monodromy is known, and if the modulus of the curves is known as a function of z, then the surface is uniquely determined, the elliptic surface is uniquely determined up to isomorphism. This is what I wanted to close with. Thank you.